Stanley.
Well, hey, everybody, this is Dave. I hope you guys are all doing great. I want to ask if there are any questions, clarifications, or any questions that you have in the beginning, and then we'll have a discussion again at the end. Remember also my offer to meet for like 15 minutes or so after the top of the hour in our final session next week, just for a discussion. I'm interested in your input, your ideas, things that you gathered or gleaned from our discussion, or things that you still would like to just talk about, and we haven't had a chance to do that in a true seminar fashion. There are a couple of questions that I got that I want to respond to now, because I can't figure out a way to work them into the discussion as I have other things, because they're really standalone and they're really excellent questions. One is, could you share some thoughts on how to assist a client in understanding what peak performance is when the individual is not performing according to their standards in both a professional and non-professional role? Two things that I would suggest you consider. One is to simply ask the client, at what percent of your capacity are you currently functioning? You may want to look at that personally or professionally. Amazingly to me, nobody ever has to think about that. They will immediately tell you 75%, 80%. If it's not 100%, then that's a coaching focus to look at and assess that and to address that. Now, to keep it for their peak performance with that person as a point of reference, I would want to know their needs and their ideals, for both of us to get familiar with that, to help them specifically focus on their personal life or performance story standards. The needs and ideals are the fundamentals of purpose for them. I will send you guys an attachment of a module that contains these two exercises, so you can get an idea of, and I'll specify, since I don't have it in another format other than in a module, which is what I use for training for New Life Story Wellness, but I'll specify the pages so you can go right to that and look at the two exercises on needs and ideals, and do it on yourself and see if it's helpful, because this is usually helpful for someone. This is probably the only regular thing that I would ask a new client to do in the beginning, is to send me their top three needs and top three ideals and give them an idea of, you know, how to go about thinking about this with sending them just a bit of information, because this is a way of aligning what we do in coaching of strategies and goals with needs and ideals to be sure that all of someone is going in the same direction. And when that's the case, it's dynamite. So that's my best answer to that, and I hope it's helpful. We can come back to that in a discussion if there's more clarification. The other question is, you talked about developing skills through practice and developing a performance memory. How does it work with those who are considered more free-flowing or free spirits? How do you coach this individual specifically? Well, this description of the free-flowing and the immersion in that performance zone is a description of performance flow, the particular state of mind where you're not thinking about it. There's no prefrontal cortex involved. To stop and think about it might result in a choke. Remember Yogi Berra's take on this. You can't hit and think at the same time. In fact, one of my my all-time childhood hero, Mickey Mantle, and I remember it beginning at age 5, and I won't tell you when that stopped, being mad at my parents because they didn't name me Mickey. He described having a discussion with, at that time, the greatest hitter of all time, Ted Williams, who had a system. He had the strike zone divided into 77 segments, and he was the most scientific baseball player ever, and by all standards, the best hitter ever. When Mantle talked with Ted Williams, he went through all kinds of instruction and help and mentoring, and they talked for about 3.5 hours. And somebody asked him later, well, how did you do with that? He said, it was absolutely fascinating. The next 31 at-bats, I never touched the ball and got struck out every time. Didn't get a hit because he was still thinking about it. So here's a brief story to indicate how, in order to be creative and in that creative zone of flow, you have to know a lot of stuff. You know, if you think about, you know, yeah, I'd like to be creative about something. But if I know nothing about it, there's no possible way it could have any meaning of creativity. Here's an illustration of that. And I know a few of you have heard this. When I was practicing psychiatry psychoanalysis, I worked with a patient who was a regionally known abstract expressionist, an artist. And he engaged in therapy to do some things, and he got even better at his work, but he described, and he became ultimately an internationally known artist, and he described his work. He said, when I go to the canvas, and he worked with large canvases, very large canvases. When I go to the canvas and emote, I'm in a zone. He didn't describe it in that way. Neither of us knew that back at this time to describe it that way, but he became at one with the canvas. He emoted on the canvas, and he just let it happen. He would do that for hours. He said, then if I step back and we were to talk about it, I could explain how this color means this, this gesture means this. He said, for 15 years, I had formal training from, you know, color to anatomy to line drawing. All of that goes into that, and it can help me understand and deconstruct it. But at the moment, it all simply informs the flow, the immersion that I'm in. That's why creativity takes practice, because all of these patterns that blend together seamlessly, all are the product of deliberate practice. But the ultimate application in a performance flow is different than performance practice. You practice at all these, and deliberate practice is a terrific system to do this, probably, in my view, the best known. But then when you're in a performance zone, you're applying it. You're not thinking about it. You're not practicing or isolating an aspect and working on it. You're in a performance zone. Think about how you are with a client. When you're focused and immersed with that client, you're like that artist at the canvas. You're letting it happen. Later, you could deconstruct where something comes from, or some theory, or some body of knowledge, or some mentor, or some training, but you're in that flow, and that's when it's magic. That's when it's fun and creative, and you let it happen. So the creativity is the result of all of this, from the practice to the performance flow. So I hope that, if I really captured the essence of your question, I hope that answers it. Any other thoughts or questions as we began, or comments from anyone? If not, I'll start and then reserve a bit of time at the end if you have questions or clarifications. I'll put us on lecture mode. Okay, we're going to talk about peak performance under pressure. I think that's something that will be beneficial for each of you and for your clients as well. So one thing to consider, I think, first, is an optimum performance mindset. You know, we've touched on this, and I want to elaborate a little bit more. The actual physiological response in your body, and especially your brain, to excitement and to fear are exactly the same. Your body, your brain, does not know the difference. The only difference between excitement and fear is how you frame it in your mind. With a response of fear or anxiety, your brain and mind search for what's wrong and may light on something that consciously makes sense and connects cause and effect. This association can create closure. And linking this physical response with a negative meaning reads it as fear. So just before you begin a task in which you've increased activation of alertness, heart racing, sweaty palms, instead of automatically linking it to anxiety or fear, then look for what caused it or what can go wrong. Instead of all that, substitute the framing of, I'm excited, I'm ready, this is the challenge I've been waiting for. And then if you want to ask a question, why am I ready to do this? That's a positive framework of anticipatory readiness. This provides the brain a context of excitement to focus on rather than looking for what's the matter, the anxiety or fear. So performance anxiety in this way is an indication of how much you care about both the performance and the outcome. It's normal, even necessary, to feel anxious as preparation for optimum performance. Frame the anxiety as the excitement to ally with the arousal, the anxiety, to channel it into performing well. And consider it as a way your mind and body both prepare to perform and then execute in the successful way you practiced. Attention awakens the prefrontal cortex for you to then insert the current framework and state of mind to determine what you do here and now. A key to consistent performance is to specifically enter and then sustain that optimum state of mind for a performance task. Preparation includes self-reflection to identify and monitor the specific state of mind for what will be optimum performance. Then, consistency requires having a systematic strategy to sustain that, to enter and sustain that state of mind so that any experience does not disrupt the flow, or if it does, to have an immediate way to reboot, to get grounded and centered. So when a performer in any endeavor has practiced essentially the same tens of thousands of hours as the next person, the outcome is determined more by optimum mental state and effective sustained focus in that state for peak performance than anything else. So a significant number of studies find the most common psychological characteristics of an optimum performance state are these five. Now, these are in your outline. Confidence with positive expectation about the performance. Full concentration with focus on the here and now task. A strong commitment that's sustained. Feeling energized but relaxed. And the mental toughness of a determined, sustained focus under pressure. Mastery of all aspects of pressure situations means being aware of any emotional triggers or negative thoughts or anything that might disrupt that focus and state. and a way to immediately get grounded and centered again, perhaps to use a performance cue to immediately get grounded and centered. And we've talked about that. A routine is effective because when that routine is repeated enough, the brain creates a neuronal pathway, a network to make it, this is default mode, to become automatic without it requiring effort. And studies have shown that performers who use a pre-performance routine, and this is as true for artists as it is surgeons, as it is athletes, perform better than those who do not have a pre-performance routine. This systematic entry into an optimum performance state of mind ensures access to that state of mind and the whole state of mind, the whole software package that contains all of those patterns of practiced excellence and a way of synthesizing those by staying in flow. Now, the quiet eye concept is from sports science. It's a strategy of attentional control. The quiet eye is a selective focus on the most significant target immediately prior to the execution of the practice skill. The quiet eye is the final step of any important performance sequence, and it's been shown to be especially important when performing under pressure. Eye tracking research on the quiet eye shows that for a precise motor task like free throw shooting, putting, tying a surgical knot, experts maintain quiet eye 62% longer than non-experts. Academic and business performers can learn a great deal from research in athletic settings to apply the quiet eye concept. Focus aligns the energy field of the brain and has the role of getting the entire system ready for the next step. For example, when soccer players miss a penalty shot, it's been found that they instantly compromise their focus more than 90% of the time from the destination of a particular part within the net of a specific spot just outside the goalpost, say the goalkeeper, which converts the specificity of that ultimate target of scoring the goal to an obstacle. Or an executive is sidetracked by an emotional reaction to a colleague during a meeting. Now, here's an example that I want to apply to self-talk and to think about at least one way systematically to apply the idea of self-talk for you to consider if it might be useful to you. A CEO, I'll call Dan, had a tragedy at his company of a serious accident and on-the-job injuries and a death resulting at one of his operating sites. In the 3 months since the accident, before he consulted me, he had had stress-related symptoms, losing sleep, depleted energy, preoccupation with safety, and not really performing well at his work, and he noticed that this was impacting other people in the executive suite and even other managers in his company. His effectiveness as an executive was hampered. I asked Dan what went through his mind the instant he woke up. His answer was, well, I didn't expect that question, but immediately I think about what can go wrong today. He then described questions about what would he do for his company? How could he not feel helpless? How could he assure the group? Is something like this bad going to happen again? Are we going to lose our position because of so all the negative things? He recognized then that the mindset he began each day for the last 3 months, every day including weekends, had been essentially the same, and he set the tone for himself and ultimately, since he was a leader, his corporation. His concern had permeated not only his team, but to each employee as he really looked at it. He knew he had to do something different, but he wasn't sure what different was. We began with a very simple approach. I explained we're always asking ourselves questions, whether or not we're conscious of them from the instant we wake up. And this internal conversation then sets in motion a mindset to initiate the day to build on. This inner dialogue is almost always unconscious, but at stressful times, it can include questions like his, what's going to happen today? Will I be able to handle it? What am I most afraid of? I suggested a very simple approach for him to try for a week, that sometime during the day or the evening, before he went to bed, he write down three questions that would put him in an empowered, positive state of mind, questions that would focus on his effectiveness, that would instantly boot up a state of mind of confidence and mastery. Some question prompts, like ones that might include a empowering, positive mindset, powerful, accomplished, unstoppable. Think about things like that that he could ask himself that would be his question. And to answer those questions each morning, immediately when he woke up, when he turned on his bedside lamp before his feet ever touched the floor. The next week at our session, he immediately reported the difference those questions had made. He recognized he had previously begun each day with negative self-talk, and it created a mindset that impacted his confidence and his stress. And with that mindset, he processed the remainder of the day and had become even more aware of how contagious it was in his organization. He knew that that was not what had created his successes. So by shifting consciously to positive self-talk, he booted up a mindset that was positive that he was familiar with, that built on itself throughout the day. So this initial reframing of his self-narrative to direct the power of focus to launch a positive state of mind to engage the day became a model that he passed on directly and indirectly to his organization. A state of mind is the most contagious thing in the world, faster than the fastest virus. He noticed within days the impact it had on his executive team and how this change trickled through his organization. Self-talk can become an internal dialogue that builds confidence. Confidence is a state of mind, remember, from our previous discussion, and creates affirmations that can directly enhance performance. And again, self-talk should not counter the negative. Remember, you get whatever you focus on. Neuroscience and quantum physics tells us that. So you don't engage the negative to try to counter it. You engage the positive. We get what we focus on, not what we want. A positive self-talk in the present moment can immediately replace a negative focus. So it's important to recognize that a different set of strategies, including self-talk and affirmations, will be needed in different performance arenas. In athletics, a runner may need a focus phrase of powerful and steady, or keep your pace during races, or I am the storm to keep from knocking off early for a single malt and a cigar. The focus phrase needs to fit the endeavor. A different example, as I mentioned before also, would be to get more effectively to sleep at night, maybe the phrase, relax to sleep. The phrase needs to fit the endeavor. It's been shown repeatedly that self-talk can enhance performance. To be most effective, self-talk needs to be brief, specific, focused. The stories we tell ourselves, our self-talk of internal conversation, often frames our experience to either sustain it or short-circuit it. Self-awareness becomes a crucial component in both monitoring and understanding this process. And here's an important aspect for coaching. The most common reason you don't get what you want is the story you tell yourself about why you can't have it. That's a coachable moment, by the way. Self-talk can enhance resilience and facilitate rebound from failure. For example, engineering professors David Franklin and Daniel Wolpert have identified 5 mechanisms of brain operation when someone successfully bounces back from failure. each brain mechanism, they're each different, has a specific corresponding brain function to allow us to directly access an inner dialogue for self-talk to rebound from failure with resilience to transform to success. I'm only going to do the highlights here, look in your outline for more detail. One, redirect negative feedback, because this focuses the brain in a negative way. So, questions for reflection. What can I learn from this? What are the possibilities here rather than the problems? Two, obstacles are created. Obstacle is not a noun. It's a verb. Consider that the obstacle you're experiencing is not something external, but something you've created as a way or strategy to stop yourself or avoid. The obstacle is not there until you create it. In other words, an obstacle is the unconscious mnemonic of desire. Show me an obstacle, I'll show you desire. And here's the coaching application. When you're ready to consider that you're creating the obstacle, you're ready to consider the possibility of not creating it. So here's the self-reflective question for this. What would it be like to not create the obstacle and instead put the energy into what you want? Three, use systematic forecasting. We have and use invisible brain algorithms to predict the future. The brain is a prediction machine, a pattern-seeking prediction machine. The self-reflective question here, is my usual pattern optimum for this situation? Four, assess the current model. Accurately, openly, honestly, assess the effectiveness of what you're doing. Is it really working? And that may require story busting, disruption of automatic expectations. You have to disrupt your own script at times. That's what we do professionally and get paid for with our clients, is to help them bust their own script. A self-reflective question, is this plan really working or not? And remember, to look at it objectively, scientifically, not continuing the story you want to inhabit or looking for validation that it could be effective. And five, the output channel is essential. Remember, we talked about this. The self-reflective question, what do I next need to put into action? So, let's look now at performing under pressure. I think this is huge. All teams, business organizations to sports, like to think they do their best when the stakes are highest, when the future rests on the immediate outcome. But that's not how it happened, except for Tom Brady. How you handle yourself in difficult and challenging moments determines success more than how you handle yourself at normal times. Think about that. Your biggest successes will come in the most challenging times. So let's let Professor Heidi Gardner at Harvard, who studied extensively various teams, she saw three patterns of handling pressure that compromise results. So this study is about teams, but also think about individual clients. When teams, sports to executive teams, become caught up in the risk of failure rather than the pursuit of excellence, they revert to standard and safe practices instead of seeking original solutions, or to the default mode rather than sticking with the new game plan. Two, when teams face significant performance pressure, they tend to defer to high-status members rather than using expert members and information. And third, when an individual or team either fails to perform well when strongly favored or else squanders a big lead in an important event, think about the Houston Texans every game, every year, but never mind, that when they do that in response to excessive pressure, when they fail to perform well or when they're strongly favored, that is something to look at. So Research on performing under pressure consistently shows that most people perform below their capacity when under pressure. This occurs in instances ranging from parallel parking. I worked in performance coaching with a guy on the West Coast who came to me because he froze up with parallel parking. It worked. We did a whole lot of great work besides parallel parking, but it was a ticket of entry to a big job interview, to a major business deal. Pressure erodes behavioral skills and our ability to perform unless it's managed in an informed, systematic manner. That's what we're doing this for, so you'll have that way of developing a systematic and informed approach with your client. So here are three simple definitions that may be important to distinguish that we'll be discussing. Stress is any situation with too many demands and too few resources to meet the demands, such as energy, time, or money. Pressure results from the significance we give a situation, the expectations we place on performance, and our stake in the outcome. In other words, that's self-generated. State of mind is a mind-body state, again, like a specific software program that determines how we perceive and then how we process information and how we respond. This is huge in terms of performance preparation and practice. Success most often has to do with how we manage our internal state under pressure-inducing circumstances. Those who develop pressure management strategies create optimal performance. Without those strategies, in pressure situations, focus can become concentrated and narrow to result in a range from mental rigidity to impulsivity to chokes. So, and that assumes the development of skill, the development of whatever skill it is through the deliberate practice. So let's talk about resilience now. This is something that we may think about in coaching, but I'm not sure we often deal with enough or bring it into focus in coaching. Theo Epstein guided the Boston Red Sox to their first World Series victory in 86 years. Then he agreed in 2011 to lead the Chicago Cubs, whose last World Series championship was in 1908. The Cubs then won in 2016, 108 years later. Now, Epstein was widely touted as having an innate and rare intelligence to deconstruct a situation into its simplest form and generate strategic possibilities. He was then asked how he decides what he looks for in putting together a team. He indicated that he scouts the person more than the player. Epstein said the first thing, the most important thing he wants to know about any potential player, how he's handled adversity. Resilience grows by converting mistakes into lessons, by reflecting on and learning from mistakes. We convert maybe an otherwise regrettable experience into a learning experience. That's the application of a growth mindset. Resilience is the ability to modulate and constructively harness the stress response. Essential also, by the way, to physical and mental health. Success in any area hinges on resilience. Management of setbacks to productively progress becomes an essential process of optimum performance. Persistence toward a goal in the face of challenges characterizes success for athletes to executives to artists. A resilient individual is not someone who avoids stress, but someone who learns how to effectively master it and optimize performance while doing so. There are four strategies that a number of studies show that can boost resilience. Reinterpreting negative events, the reframing that we talked about, enhancing positive emotions, becoming physically fit no matter what the performance, intellectual, creative, physical, becoming physically fit, and for maintaining a supportive social network to imitate resilience role models. The ability to distinguish and regulate states of mind and manage emotions is central to establishing resilience. Two approaches, and you see a brief exercise for one of these in your resources section. Sustained research to regulate states of mind and enhance resilience. Cognitive reappraisal, mindfulness meditation. There's a two-minute mindfulness meditation exercise in your resource section. Cognitive reappraisal is basically a fancy way of describing reframing. You reframe from a negative to a positive, from problem to possibility, in order to reinterpret the meaning of an adverse event to see it as a challenge and opportunity. Cognitive reappraisal simply means you're aware that you assign meaning, and if you want to assign a different meaning, you got to do it yourself. A Mount Sinai School of Medicine study of Vietnamese prisoners of war found that those who had actively reappraised their imprisonment to find meaningful ways in which to grow stronger and more resilient showed far and away the most adaptive responses. Mindfulness meditation focuses on how to get grounded and centered in the present moment rather than dwelling in the past. It's been associated with improved ability to focus, increased flexibility of thinking, greater psychological well-being, and immune response. It's simply a brief, simple, specific model of focus. You focus on your breath. If you give up that focus, which your brain is programmed to do, and think about it, you let it throw away, refocus on your breath. It's a model for focus. It's a model for focusing on your client's experience during a coaching session. So both cognitive reappraisal and mindfulness meditation have been shown to increase activation of the left prefrontal cortex, a brain activation pattern associated, even though it's the thinking brain, with greater emotional control, boost of positive emotions, and faster recovery from uncomfortable feelings. And here's a really simple acronym, STOP, S-T-O-P. This is a quick and easy version of mindfulness meditation. Stop, take a breath, observe what's going on, proceed, S-T-O-P. The neuroconditioning chart that we've already talked about can be applied here. In the emotional triggers column, list all the situations that may instantly induce an emotional reaction. In the second column, usual response, write your usual reactive response for each situation. The purpose is to cue your radar to be instantly aware when a situation arises, as we've talked before, to identify it quickly, not to stay in that time capsule of column two. Then, recognizing it, move to column three, get grounded and centered with the mantra, and then to move to the ideal response, the pre-planned response once this balance and regulation have been established. Do this for every emotional trigger that you're aware of. Now, how can you restore mental energy during an optimum performance? One is the framing, to think about rest as a part of practice. You know, athletes know this. You're not dogging it. You're not being lazy if you rest at a prescribed time, because that's part of performance too. So instead of viewing rest as passive or not training, let's look at it in a different way. A buddy of mine who's a Harvard neuropsychiatrist, Dr. Srini Pillai, P-I-L-L-A-Y. You've heard me, some of you have heard me reference his book, Tinker, Dabble, Doodle, Try, a great book. He calls it unfocus. And by doing unfocus to frame rest and unfocused time as supporting achievement and focus creates a framework that's effective and proactive. In this reframe, rest becomes a crucial component of work performance. So what he's decided, what he's looked at, is the optimum amount of rest for each task, and it has its own kind of timetable. For example, cognitive work. For every hour that you spend doing cognitive work, if you take a break for that last 6 minutes and do a walk in the outdoors, your productivity of the next hour will be 60% greater because you've restored mentally, you've recharged. If you can't walk outdoors, and he being in Boston has to look out the window for much of the winter month, looking out the window at nature can increase your productivity the next hour by 40%. Every kind of work and worker, pretty much within a reasonable range, has been studied. For example, farmers, 60 minutes on and 50 minutes off, and 15 minutes off, a 75-minute cycle. Similar for everything from meat packers to other kinds of work, there's an optimum amount of time that's unfocused that will enhance productivity. And that's been studied in a number of ways, but I won't bore you with that. But it also enhances tapping into unconscious processes like creativity. Now, let's look at a particular kind of mindset, playing to win versus playing not to lose. Let's go back to soccer. For a soccer penalty kick, every player has the same setup. They're 12 yards away. There's a 72-square-foot target guarded by one goalie. Now, when playing to win, in other words, when making the goal will result in a win, kickers are successful 92% of the time. Same situation, except when they're playing not to lose. In other words, the team is down by one, and you have to make it to tie. If you miss, your team will lose. Success rate, 62%. Same distance, same target, two different mindsets. 30% difference in success rate. In the threat mindset, expectations are high. There's the feeling of judgment. You can't make a single mistake. You're focusing on the negative. You play not to lose. The result is more anxiety, booting up an entirely different mindset from the playing to win mindset. So look at those bullets about the distinction of playing to win. Playing to win based in confidence, playing not to lose based in fear. One, playing to win optimizes performance. Playing not to lose is defensive. Look at those in the outline. And basically, here's the thinking. We seek pleasure by playing to win. We avoid pain by playing not to lose. When you two different mindsets. When you play not to lose, you most likely assure loss because this shifts the operating system of the brain. They're two separate neurochemical systems and pathways. One neural system wired to seek pleasure by winning, the other system wired to curtail risk and avoid mistakes to avoid the pain and play not to lose. You get what you focus on. With gain orientation, we take risk, look for potential reward. Prevention orientation generates caution to avoid risk. And the closer we get to a goal, the greater weight of the tendency to shift into prevention orientation. Keep that in mind as you're working with your clients and they get closer and closer to their goal. Now, an application. A situation can be seen as a challenge, the perception of an opportunity to shift mindset to the reward center to take risk, activating the gain orientation system. A threat warns to shut down to avoid mistakes. Two different mindsets. Two different levels of performance and results. So, important to keep in mind. Now, in terms of a couple more things I want to highlight and then take questions and comments. Performance anxiety management. I think this is really significant, and I included in the outline, the detail of the pressure management tools, and the detail also of the roadmap to look at performing under pressure. I'm going to let you look at that, maybe do some work on that, but to go into that more in your own way in detail. So I just want to talk about some aspects of application and performance. And remember first, performance can depend, how you perform, can depend on whether you interpret anxiety or excitement. Focus needs to remain on the state of flow and the successful execution of skill, whatever it is. A worry, a thought, a fear of failure can boot up the mindset to avoid pain and play not to lose. Consider recognizing any of these as error messages from your brain in order to instantly focus on optimum mindset and reframe in a performance flow. And think about the various ways that someone will disguise, even from themselves, avoiding a loss rather than playing to win. In elite performance of any type, there's some unique issues around success completion. Now, I want to consider with you the four most common success completion issues: choking, sandbagging, self-handicapping, and burnout. Guarantee you've heard each of these from your clients, even though you haven't called them this maybe. First, choking. When Jackie Robinson grabbed his throat in a game between St. Louis and the Dodgers back in 1953, when my hero was just beginning his ascendancy, when umpire Bill Stewart badly missed a call, Stewart threw him out of the game. Choking became a common term for just blowing it. Choking usually refers to not executing a specific skill under pressure that somebody has been trained and would likely perform very well and execute under normal circumstances. Some common scenarios of choking: botching a routine behavior like catching a pass in a big game, flubbing a well-practiced presentation, an actor forgetting lines, this said 100 times, blanking on the name of someone the person knows really well. So understanding how choking happens can help reduce the occurrence and promote optimum performance. Now, when anyone shifts from the bottom up, the natural performance flow, to the top-down system, to think about it, even for a second, it can create a choke. So two particular behaviors can increase pressure and distort the ability to perform under pressure. One is framing a situation as a unique experience. This is my biggest game. There will never be an opportunity like this. Today I make history. Thinking of a pressure moment as a single shot can heighten the sense of risk and loss. Here's an example. In the 2017 American League Baseball Championships, the starting Astros pitcher in Game 3 against the Yankees was Charlie Martin. That was back in the days when I was still an Astros fan, before they cheated. When he was interviewed before the game, he said, "This is the biggest game of my life." And my response at that time was, "Oh, no, man. The Yankees got 6 runs in the first 2 innings." You see how right my grandmother was? If you're not having fun, you're not doing it right. And the second for choking is exaggerating a situation, becoming too attached to the outcome, intensified thoughts of fear and anxiety, especially focusing on what might go wrong. Anxiety causes a shift of state so that the performer can lose focus and move away from working memory. So the meaning we ascribe to an event can create pressure or the flow of performance. Here's an example. In research examining 185 venture capital pitches, they do on Shark Tank, variables such as calmness, passion, eye contact, and confidence were significantly greater predictors of outcome than content, experience, and expertise. These behavioral responses to pressure were to sustain that balanced state of mind and specific mindset of confidence to ensure the most favorable outcomes, to induce that state of confidence and positivity in the people who are receiving it. Second, self-handicaps. Dr. Eddie O'Connor reported the recognition of his process of self-handicapping as a runner. He recognized in not reaching his goal for the half mile in 2:10 that he was holding back to have something left at the end of each race, coupled with the hope that he could get there the next time by trying harder. He kept hope alive by this self-handicap. He recognized that by preserving the hope of doing better was interfering with doing better, the I can always try harder. The remedy for self-handicaps, self-reflection, and awareness of this process. Another, sandbagging. Sandbagging attempts to demonstrate in some way a limitation or a negative aspect to diminish others' expectations of you. It's designed to diminish the pressure of performance anxiety. In one extensive study, sandbaggers who predicted lesser performance made it a self-fulfilling prophecy. Well, I may have lost, but it really doesn't count because I didn't try. So both self-handicapping and sandbagging are designed to preserve integrity and to avoid pain. That's the key, to avoid pain. A specific remedy for sandbagging? Change self-talk. And the last, burnout. It's a syndrome, as you know, comprised of a collection of aspects, including diminished emotional drive, concentration, motivation, and enthusiasm. It's often the result of the chronic experience of stressful performance. You've heard more about this since COVID, especially with healthcare practitioners. Someone experiences tension, fatigue, lethargy. The remedy for burnout, mindfulness with reappraisal and re-engagement. And in various studies, greater mindfulness and this 2-minute mindfulness meditation, for example, is associated with restoring energy and cognitive reserves, as well as developing more positive engagement with the endeavor. So look at, in the outline, the pressure management tools that I have outlined. And these are pretty much in sequence. In other words, to begin with getting grounded and centered and booting up previous success, framing the pressure moment as a challenge. Keep in mind the purpose, the overall motivation, and go through each of these. And then maybe at the end, after it's all over, use the roadmap system for performing under pressure to see what you can deconstruct and learn about how you might address this. So, again, the roadmap, remember I asked in our last initial seminar, do you know how to decipher existing programming and write new code for your brain? Somewhere inside each of us are the algorithms, the self-contained sequence patterns for behaviors, attachment, emotions. We may not know the formula, but we see the clues, the manifest patterns. That's why, as coaches, we'll never have to go back into the past or ask why question. If it's important, you're going to see it manifest in the interaction, in the exchange, in the process of your client engaging with you. They're going to show you exactly what it's like to be them. So this roadmap system is designed to help you develop awareness of those algorithms, of how someone constructs their story, in order to know how and where and in what way to deconstruct it with a client, to look at how to engage with a client to begin. So I would suggest this as an exercise. Return to your neural conditioning chart, that 4-column. Work with the first emotional trigger you wrote. And I know each of you have done your homework. You have an emotional trigger there. Work with that first one. Go through these 7 steps as a prompt for understanding your story to illustrate how to roadmap a state of mind for performing under pressure. Recognize the emotional trigger. Observe the state change. Assess the ideal state of mind for the task. Decide on a predetermined strategy. For example, which pressure management tool and the ideal response or behavior. Next, map the next best action. Author the ideal response. Bring it about. Execute the optimum performance. Then, finally, and this is not a single step, program your peak performance identity to transform how and who you see yourself doing and being in your performance zone successfully. Incorporate the new behavior as part of your core self. Remember, I've mentioned, I know repeatedly, one of the most powerful forces of the human psyche is we always return to our core identity. You know, kind of like when somebody trips, you learn their native language. When new behavior is incorporated into core identity, it becomes permanent. It becomes part of that operating model that's transformed and revised that we're helping clients do each step of the way. Change that lasts as the default mode. Your brain has rewired. This is what makes change permanent. So we're in discussion mode now. I'm very interested in thoughts or clarifications, questions, anything you'd further like to talk about, any aspect of this that might be helpful.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, who is this?
Hi, this is Christine.
Yeah, thank you for those questions. I hope I answered those at the beginning in a way that was helpful to you.
Well, I missed the first 10 minutes.
You're going to have to listen to the recording then because I responded to you specifically.
I was cleaning my closets and grabbed a bite to eat, and before I knew it, it was 10 after 6, and I'm like, oh,
my gosh.
So, anyway, you have something
to look forward to with the recording. It will be posted at least by tomorrow morning, okay?
Okay, great. Yeah. I'll look for it.
Thanks for those questions. Those were great. Appreciate it.
Yeah.
And you have a clean closet. What more could you ask?
I know. It's wonderful. It's a beautiful thing. It's a beautiful thing.
Yeah, I know.
I do have some other things that I considered when you were, as you were speaking tonight.
Pick the question you most want to ask, and then I'm going to be sure I get to others who have questions also. What's the one that's top of your list?
I'll just address the first one.
Okay.
You identify performance or peak performance in such a way that it appears you're elevating peak performance or performance to the upper 10% or even more elite than that. And what, you know, honestly, I'm not going to be working with that population. I'm just not.
May I interrupt you?
Uh-huh.
Okay. I think this is important that you listen to my initial response because that's not what I'm inferring. This is not a comparison. This is about someone's optimum performance themselves, 100% for themselves. So this is where the grounding in their own needs and ideals, how they measure performance, and what you're helping each client do for what their measure of success, their internal point of reference to develop the optimum story that they want, whether it's life or wellness or money or performance. This is about you're helping a client optimize that client's story. And I think you'll hear a more complete response to that in the recording. So I hope that addresses it for right now, and thanks for that.
May I interrupt you
to be sure I get other questions or responses? I'll come back to yours if I hear nothing else, okay? Is that a deal?
That's fine.
Okay. Any other questions or responses or thoughts any of you have I'm interested in hearing feedback or questions or clarifications. Who else?
Hi, this is Mark.
Hey, Mark, go ahead.
I have a question when it comes to stress, and I'm going to call it stress branding. So when we have impacts to our performance, I'm imagining that stress is stress. So if it's post-traumatic stress, financial stress, marital stress, no matter what, the brain is kind of reacting the same. Is that accurate?
Well, there are common pathways of that. But also remember that stress is our own internal generation of our experience and our response. So stress is not there until we create it. So it's not something that's there externally as a standalone. It's our own interpretation and experience of that. So I would work with the individual about looking at and creating a story that is optimum for this situation. Remember, I described stress as something like it's generated in any situation, too many demands, too few resources, energy, time, or money. So that's an optimum time for the use of strategic coaching. This is also, or especially, where we can earn our money to help someone create a system that doesn't contain or result in stress. And remember, everybody has the same goal. What we do in coaching is to look at the system. If you want to change, if you want to create a different way of experiencing something other than stress, look at the system. You heard one system of cleaning out the closet. There was no stress during that. In fact, it was so relaxing, Christine forgot about the time of the beginning of this. So does that help with your specific response and question?
Yes, I believe so. What I'm hearing you say is not to necessarily focus on the type or the cause of the stress, but focus on the outcome that we want. So whether we're
I would say focus on the individual and how that individual experiences and perceives how they address that, the mindset they use to boot it up, and strategically how they can proceed in a way that doesn't generate stress. If someone has an overwhelming number of tasks to do, what's the first step they take? You know, the Terry Fox story. It would be overwhelming to think about 3,337 miles. That would be stressful for anybody, but he approached it in a different way. He just went to the next telephone pole, and he did that for each telephone pole until he got to the end of the Marathon of Hope. So that's an illustration of what we do, of creating a map and a next step to focus on that, because for the next step, there's not a stress, it's a step. You create otherwise what may be ineffective or helpless to a step that can create effectiveness. That's the most basic desire we have as human beings. And we help someone do that in a stepwise way. That's a motivation I mentioned earlier. I've seen direct infant observation studies of normal kids as early as 3 months of life who have effectance pleasure, the pleasure at being a cause. That motivation of effectiveness is there until our last breath. It motivates everything that we do to be effective. When we can help someone create a system to do that in a stepwise way, we'll create with them an alternative to stress, anxiety, overwhelm, because it's the next step. And then after that, what's the next step? Does that help with an approach to that?
Absolutely. Beautiful. Thank
you
very much.
Great. Thanks. I know we're over time. I apologize for that. I wasn't watching. Jot down anything you'd like to discuss or just talk about in greater length, and we'll tack on the time at the end of our last seminar next week and do that. And I'll hang with you as long as there's some questions and discussion. So think about that. Keep in mind anything you'd like to talk more about, of anything we've talked about or haven't yet. Thanks very much for all of your input all the kind words and things you send in, we'll pick up right here next time for our final seminar. Have a great rest of the week. Take good care of yourselves. See you guys. Bye now.
Thank you.
See you.
Thank you.